Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 258, my chat with artist Sherry Flanders. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Today's episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. So I've been on a bit of a John Scalzi binge. His fiction is dark, and I like it. First, I listened to The Dispatcher, read by Zachary Quinto. That was really good. Then I jumped headfirst into Lock-In, because my teen crush, Will Wheaton, is reading it. Juicy stuff so far. Head on over to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy right now and download the app. You'll get a free audiobook and access to hundreds of books and podcasts that are included with your membership. Now's the time. Get Audible. Yes But Why podcast is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. My husband and I run the company, PodcastCadet.com, to help people with podcasting. We can help you with some little detail you can't figure out, or we can help you with all of your podcast episodes. Connect with us now at PodcastCadet.com. Use promo code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week, Yes But Why chats with Sherry Flanders, a Chicago-based actor, comedian, writer, and visual artist. Listen in as we talk about her experiences with designing fashion, writing film reviews, and making comedy with her husband. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 258. Sherry Flanders on pushing the boundaries of art and culture. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah. What was the first time in your life when you did a creative thing like performing or art where you were like, I really love this and I want this to be part of my whole life?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know if that I actually have ever been answered that, or asked that one. I did a lot of creative things as a youth, so I can't say what came first. But I would say the biggest ones when I was young were probably writing, because I used to write lots of silly stories. And also my aunt taught me how to sew at a young age. So I guess actually drawing predated sewing, but they were kind of linked. I learned how to draw. I eventually got into drawing images from fashion magazines. And my aunt taught me how to sew, which then kind of led me on this longer path to fashion. But yeah, so it was the visual arts initially. But then I also had two other sisters. I'm the oldest. And so we would sing songs together and do little skits together. So there was also kind of a informal performance portion to it as well. So yeah, I did kind of all the things creatively at a young age. And I think it's always been with me, and it's always been a thing I was going to do.
Did you always know, even when you were really little, that this would be something that you would be super active in? Or
yeah, because I mean, I think especially I'm from that kind of working class of you're always thinking of what you're going to do when you grow up, what's going to be your career, and it's always something very practical, what can you do, what are you good at? And I was somebody who was good at doing artistic things, and so it's well, clearly you're going to be an artist. Whether or not one could actually make a living at that was sort of beside the point, but it was obviously I was good with my hands, I was good with drawing creative things, and so yeah. I mean, there were certainly never I'm going to become a mathematician, because I suck at math. So,
all right, right on. You're like, listen, I was scientist, no, mathematician, no.
Actually, I did want to become at one point a brain surgeon, but then I was just I suck at math, so I can't be this brain surgeon who sucks at math. So clearly, I'm not going down that road.
Is there a lot of math in brain surgery, I wonder?
I mean, just kind of assumed. If a brain surgeon told me that they were bad at math. I would be like, you're not operating.
I don't know. I mean, I guess you're right. Like, I don't know. I don't know how you fix brains. So I guess that's why.
I don't either.
I don't know. I was like, it's just like a knife and a brain, right? And then I was like, no, he probably has to read books and make decisions about what he's going to cut and like know about what angle to cut at and blah, blah, blah.
And
that's math. Yeah, that's math. I don't know. I was really hoping for some math deficient brain surgeons for some reason. I don't know why I'm trying to make that happen.
Don't make that one happen. We can let that one go.
Oh man, well, you know, but so like, did your whole family go like, oh, Sherry's definitely gonna be an artist, like from early on? I mean, like, my family was definitely oh, Amy's a performer, but there were also other performers that were adults in my family, so like the idea of having it as a job was real in my like life because there was a person who I knew who did. Is that something that happened in your life? Was that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I think of like early influences, I mean, the biggest in my family was my Aunt Regina. She's passed since, but she was a singer and a dancer in a reggae band. And her and awesome. Her husband, it was called Reaganomics, and they were amazing. She had a beautiful voice. She was gorgeous. And we would go out and see them play at all the various cultural festivals in town. And, you know, when I got to like a certain age as a teenager, my immediate family actually is, they're Muslim converts. And my extended family is Christian. And so my mom is a fairly conservative is not quite the right word, because it kind of has a different meaning in like African American families than it does in like the public lexicon. But you know, she was not somebody who was like going to bars. And then I remember one year when I was like a teenager, she like took me, not my younger sisters, to go to a bar to see my aunt perform on stage. And I was just like, I get to be in a bar and see my aunt, and I feel so grown up. And it was amazing. So, you know, like, she was huge. Like, I wanted to be like her, no doubt. Like, she was a huge influence. And so, yes, because she was there, there was also this, yes, well, clearly Sherry's also going to be an artist too. Anybody who wanted to do that could do that, because there was this path, at least for certain concrete artistic jobs.
Wow. That's great. I mean, if only just because, I mean, I definitely have my own experience, but most people I talk to, either their parents are like, no, or you know, they're like, yeah, you should be an artist, but I don't know what that is or where you find it. So there's a lot of that.
I mean, like, they didn't necessarily have guidance on it.
Sure.
There certainly was the, like, you're going to be an artist because like that's what you're clearly good at doing, but also that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be like gainfully employed, and so like we're going to pin all hopes on the future on your middle sister who's probably going to go do something more practical. But like, follow your dreams, kid, figure it out. Good luck.
Hey man, that's great. I'm glad that you did. Or when you did you actually follow those dreams, or were you more conservative small c? I think that's how you differentiate, by the way. It's like conservative small c is what you mean, where it's like, she's not going to bars, whereas capital C is more like, oh, that kind of right.
Yeah, because she wasn't like socially conservative, you know, in many ways, just small c, like, yeah. Wait, what was the question?
It's kind of just about like where did you go with your creative interests at that point? Were you able to jump into doing work in the arts, or, you know, did you get a regular job because you were like, well, that's great that you guys are supportive, but I need to make rent?
It was both, actually. Yeah. I think my life has always like existed on two tracks, right? So like on the one hand, like I did my first fashion show when I was 16, right? There was a local organization in town, called Fashion Forward. And, you know, they brought together a bunch of young designers and we sewed our own things and we put them on models and it was amazing. And so I always had the hands on, you know, fully in, but at the same time recognizing like, I don't really know where I go with this in Indianapolis, Indiana, which is not the fashion mecca of the world. and so when I graduated from high school, you know, my parents are like, we love you, but we can't afford to pay for you to go to college, even though I had gotten accepted to the Art Institute of Chicago here. And I wanted to go, and we had gone on the school visit, and then they were like, we just can't afford that beautiful art school. So I went for a few semesters to a local art school, part of IUPUI, what used to be called Heron School of Art, and tried to work, and went to the workforce. Did retail management in the beginning. But while I was doing that, I also did a little community theater. When I was in high school, I did some mostly costumes and then slowly started moving onto the stage. And then after graduation, did some community theater. But then after time, I couldn't really juggle both wanting to work and have a salary and be able to afford my own apartment and do that. So the theater portion kind of fell off, but I always stayed with the fashion portion. And then eventually, probably a decade later, went back to college in Chicago to pursue fashion design and got my fashion design degree.
Oh, awesome. So were you doing fashion design sort of like on your own previous, like during the 10 years in between?
Yes, yes, definitely on my own, trying to like launch my own brand with whatever that means in the town such as Indianapolis, you know. All of my friends were artists in some right. So either some people who were other designers, some people who were painters, a lot of musicians. At that time, my ex-husband was a musician. And so I was hanging deep with the music crew, the music guys. That thing was going on. So yeah, so I was always kind of nurtured by this artistic community and always had a hand in an artistic community.
That's nice that Indianapolis has such a vibrant artistic community that you could find this crowd of friends.
I would not call it vibrant.
But, there were six of you and that was everyone.
I mean, it's just like anywhere. It's like there's lots of artists. It's just, and it's not vibrant. I mean, like if you go to Indianapolis, you can find pockets of art. It's just not as much as here in Chicago. And if you are looking for art in that capital A to try to stack it up against what folks might value in a larger city, there will certainly be a certain amount of like looking down the nose at it in terms of, you know, what kind of art, what tastes are popular or whatever sometimes. But valid artists, great artists, just people doing art, just in that like very normal everyday, like I am an artist and I, you know, express myself as an artist and I'm just going to do it for my own enjoyment and maybe try to find my way in a small town with people don't always have the resources to get out of the city. Like I got out of Indianapolis because I had a little tiny 401k via my retail management jobs and I cashed it out. And that was my money to move out and to be enrolled in college.
Wow. Good on you for doing that 401k.
Right? Everybody, invest.
Yeah.
Invest.
I'm telling you. I don't have any of those. I never had a job where that was a thing. So I'm glad that you have those. I hear about those. They sound interesting.
It wasn't much. It was like $700. Like, let's not get...
If you want to go to another city, you only need a small nest egg to get yourself moving to actually get it going. So that's not too bad. That's nice.
I mean, but that was like unheard of for me. Like people, like, but it was terrifying. Like, I don't want it to be like, it was so easy. It was terrifying. I was not someone who had ever lived in a big city. Indianapolis is like not a small city, but it feels like a small town. So when I moved to Chicago, I thought I was going to get killed and shot the way that everybody not from Chicago thinks is going to happen in this town. I was scared to take the train because I was like, there's no bar between the train and the platform and I could fall off into that platform or somebody could push me in front of the train. Like, you know, there were like homeless people on the street. That's not a thing in Indianapolis in the same way because it's a driving town. So, you know, poverty is like in pockets and I wasn't rich, but there's like levels of poverty, obviously. And so I was like, my family, I would say is like lower upper class, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I hear you.
So Yep. So it's like we had to change apartments every year because, you know, we couldn't afford the rent at the end of the lease sort of thing, you know. So
Yeah, they do it was just always make it more expensive every year. I hate that.
Yeah,
that's the worst. You're like, I didn't get richer.
Yeah, and my dad was a a vet, and so he had PTSD, and so there were struggles financially, and things were not always easy. But my parents loved me; they worked hard, and we made do. But I certainly, when I came to Chicago, I did not have the tools. I was very naive. Existing in a big city was a huge learning curve.
So big culture shock, huh?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Now wait,
I still have to this day, my aunt will call me and be like, I heard there was a shooting in Chicago. Are you okay? And I'm like, this city is so big. I'm alive. It's okay.
I know. I have people like that too. Where like literally anything happens and I'm like, listen, I appreciate you calling me, but this city is a lot bigger than you think it is.
It's like we all live on like one block. It's so funny.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I do usually live right next to wherever it is. We heard this thing and I was like, it's not near me. Where was it? Oh, really? It was right there. Oh, yeah, that's near my house. But yeah, I'm fine because I don't leave my home ever. So you're fine.
There's machine gun fire two blocks over, actually, like a few weeks ago. And I heard it and I was like, that's probably fireworks. And I was like, that's not fireworks. And I went on Facebook and somebody was like, the police said it was a machine gun fire. And I'm like, okay, it's fine. But then also just brush it off and keep going at this point. So
yeah. Well, I feel like right now at this very moment in the world, it's a little bit crazier. Like there are definitely shootings in places where it is surprising there are shootings here where you're like, wait, what? Somebody was shooting up a gas station where? So there's a lot of wackiness, I think, happening all over the place. And it's like not just sort of contained anymore. And I say contained with air quotes. But
yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't say that I live in the, I live in Rogers Park in Chicago. I don't know if you're familiar with Chicago, but it's like the last neighborhood north of the suburbs. And it's probably one of the most diverse neighborhoods on the north side, which is why I like it and I like being here. But there are certainly, folks from other neighborhoods who are like, I would never live in Rogers Park because it's rough, sort of thing. Mm. And it's like, well, good, don't come here. But
absolutely. No, I understand. I mean, people always have these weird opinions. It definitely happens in my town as well, where they're like, oh, I don't go over there. And I was like, why? Like, it's fun. It's awesome. Do you want to know where you shouldn't go? I'll tell you where not to go, but it's not here. Oh, man. Before we get into the deep culture shock of Chicago, I'm interested in, your fashion design and the way that it manifested for you. Like, it's one thing to want to, draw clothing and, make people, put people in clothing. Oh, I want them to look good. I want to put this. But the idea of making clothing is so, there's something so sort of like natural and organic about this idea of wanting to create in this way, but like also fabulous. Like, the fact that it got done, A, and B, like this fashion show when you're 16, that you really like glossed over that real fast. But like, tell me more from like a, artistic perspective, like what moves you when you're doing fashion design? Like what's the thing that keeps you going with it? What makes you, what drives you to continue doing it?
Well, first I'll say I've let it go. I don't do it anymore other than like once in a while I'll make something to myself for fun. I've been out of it for a while now. I don't know how many years, a minute. But when I was younger, it was just this great way, this great mode of self-expression. Like I mentioned before, like my family was Muslim. And I was definitely the black sheep of the family. I definitely, was an avid reader. I discovered early on that I was an atheist. I like all this cool, weird science fiction stuff. And my parents like science fiction stuff too. So I don't want to say that we're so different. We're actually a lot alike in a lot of ways, but I was definitely like the next step over where I was more embracing of, this of, you know, what would, might be considered a more wild life or existence, more bohemian, whatever, artist life, however you want to phrase it. And they were more like, we're looking at this life more from a distance through books and through TV, but we're not necessarily living it in that way. But at the same time, I think they also admired it to a certain level that it was living in that way. But being in a Muslim family, there is also like, well, we can't be seen as allowing our daughter to be, you know, scandalous. So for me, you know, to be able to wear mini skirts and, you know, cool things like all the other teenagers was a thing that I wanted to do, was had certain, and I had certain restrictions on that. So I learned to play with fashion to be able to push those boundaries as much as possible. And quite frankly, often just had a change of clothing in my backpack after I left home, like many a teenager does. But also I have kind of like this, like, you know, I spoke about being bad at math, but it's not entirely true. I'm good at like geometry. I'm good at like, kind of like, I have a bit of an, like, all I can say is like an engineering brain, being able to think abstractly. And I love to put things together with my hands. I love that idea of being able to turn something around in my mind's eye and see it from all different sides and build it. And how does the fabric, you know, work with each other, different types of fabric, the seams. I enjoyed it. I just enjoy it. It's just, I like to spend a lot of time alone. And so like when you're sewing something, you can spend like hours alone in this kind of mental creative world. And then at the end, you have something great to show for it. It's just fun. And then also, obviously, if you make something and you go out in the world, and you're like, I look beautiful, or you style something. It was just this thing that I just enjoyed. And that's been most of my art. It's like I just at some point enjoyed it. And then at a certain point, it became a career. And when it became a career, I realized that the doing it from a hands-on perspective for my own enjoyment is different than turning it into a career, you know, and then, you know, some of the fun fades when that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently saw, like, this commercial where it's like a spoof on 9 to 5, but it's 5 to 9, about how between the hours of 5 and 9, you're working on your own little craft and how you can turn that into a business. And I was like, I thought we all agreed that was a bad thing to be selling to people. Like, it's not that it's bad inherently, but like, don't just tell everyone that's what you should do, because it works for some people, but does not work for other people. And you can't just, it's hard thing about art is that like, you should just be able to enjoy it without having to worry about selling it or, you know, figuring out how to pay your rent while doing it. Like, it's something so human to want to create something. And I love this idea of you, you know, pushing boundaries with your fashion and like, you know, decorating your world a little bit more. And I'm sorry that sort of the real world of it, which probably thinking about fashion design probably is very hard and crazy.
You know, could so, be... I didn't have the personality for it. I'm not mean enough.
Yeah.
And I can be plenty mean when I want to, but, you know, like I don't have that streak in me to really do it in that way.
Yeah. You know, I think about that all the time. Like there's competition and there's competition. Like, you know, because, you know, sometimes I'll say to people, you know, I'm not competitive. And they'll go, yeah, you are. And I was like, yeah, but I'm not competitive. Like I want to hurt everyone who does what I do because I gotta be the only one, or like I
have. And that's not even competitive. That's like vicious.
Yeah. I mean, but to a certain extent, like, that's kind of how you have to be in some of these. I mean, even acting, you know, like fashion design, acting,
it's the same.
You have to be cutthroat. You have to keep doing stuff. You have to, you know, move forward in ways that like maybe aren't what you wanted to, because it's an uphill battle. And there's so many people trying to vie for like two positions that happen once every 10 years that it's like, you know, because it's like, yeah, you can be in a film or you can have a runway show wherever you'd like. But, you know, people aren't going to give you millions and millions of dollars for your purses or your dresses until you get to a certain point. Like, well,
and also like as a designer, one thing that I learned too late was that if you actually want to launch your own brand, you have to basically have a rich family member willing to give you like $1 million. Like, you can't work your way up that way. Most of the people at the top are like, I knew somebody. You know, it's really hard to really walk in as a girl from Indiana. But also, like, I want to kind of, like, add nuance to the whole, like, is it for fun or is it for a job? Because also at the time that I was going to school for fashion design, I was going to school for full time and I was working in retail management full time. So I was doing that bell to bell, like 9 to 5, 5 to 9, 9 all the time and barely having time to eat or like live a life. And so like in retail is a horrible, horrible field. And I was happy to leave it behind. And so comparatively, working in fashion was a dream, you know, to go from a job where you like, you know, have, well, I was a manager, but, you know, monitoring other people's bathroom breaks or feeling like, oh my gosh, I've been on my, you know, feet for 9 hours straight and I still have to work 3 more hours in this extra long shift and I'm wearing high heels and I can't sit down. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there were points of doing that where like my hair was falling out. I was getting rashes, you know, that type of stuff. But, you know, I was super skinny because I was losing all this weight from stress. You know, so then like to be able to go to work and do something that is based in art is a blessing. Right. So I don't want to discount the idea that like working in art fully demeans the art because I don't think that's true. I think there's more nuance to it. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Plus, I think it's individual to individual. It depends on what's going on. Like, if you're a big personality these days, I would say you need to be like, you know, loud Instagram like person to get any attention for anything. Like, if you want to be an actor or if you want to be a fashion designer, somebody's got to notice you. So you have to be like, hey, check this out. What's going on? Like, and you have to do that. No matter what rooms you're walking into, is to be like, you know, everyone has to notice that I'm there and they have to be happy that I'm there. And
hey, I'm the it girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much. I mean,
there's a lot of like sort of that work that is not real. I mean, I'm sure they go home and they're like, God, I'm so tired. But at the same time, like that's the effort that they have to put in because that's what people expect, right?
Oh, I'm so glad that I like came up before the internet was so ubiquitous. Like I had an email at like graduation from high school, but like I didn't have anybody to email. You know, it wasn't until years later that I was like, oh, this is a daily part of my life.
Yeah. When I went to college, they had a computer terminal in the like main hall where they had the cafeteria. And that was the place you went to make your email and check your email. And everyone on the whole campus used that one email. I mean, used that one computer.
That's amazing.
Isn't that wild?
Oh, my gosh. I remember in high school, because I went to a big high school, and it was, like, very well-funded, and it had all the things. It was, like, the second biggest one in the state. And I remember at one point, they were like, look, we have a computer lab, and we had computer class. And we would be sitting in front of these computers, like trying to figure out how to use Excel or something. And we'd be like, hey, teacher, can you help us with this? We're kind of stumped. And they're like, I don't know how to use this. And so we were basically teaching ourselves. It was such a weird time to imagine that there was a time when people didn't really know the basics on how to navigate a computer.
Oh, 100%. We've been talking a little bit about this idea of like the effort that is required to like sort of propel yourself in this art world, right? Certainly in fashion, in a lot of stuff, but that didn't stop you. You still do different performance and art that is, you know, pretty high stakes. How did you end up after how many years, first of all, how many years ago did you stop doing fashion design?
Boy, when did I stop? I'm trying to think of when I was, I think Miami was like the last time when I was doing it like fully in earnest. And then it took a few years to like kind of get it out of my soul. I want to say I was there in I'm really bad with the dates, so you're going to have to forgive me.
It's okay. I think I've been out of college. Yeah.
No, because okay, I'm old, and you know, I'm 44. So like, there was like a decade. I didn't go to college directly after high school. I went to college for like a semester or two. Then I dropped out locally, and then I waited. So you know, worked. Time to build up that 401k, right? And then moved to Chicago, and only then did I go to Chicago and went to college and graduated. And that was 2007 when I graduated. And then I met my husband, and we were together for a few years, and then we went to Miami, and then after Miami was kind of right when I gave it up.
Goodness.
Aw, little one.
No, he's just trying to put him to bed, and he's like just trying to jump and attack me in this moment.
Yeah, those are my nieces and nephews. I feel you. I feel you. Been there. Totes know it.
So you were in Miami for a few years, and that's when it kind of like moved out of your sort of like artistic purview. Was it because you just needed to like move forward from it, or did you find something else?
I think it was a confluence of a few things. When I graduated from college in 2007, that was right about the time that there was the recession and the market crashed. And when a market crashes and there's a recession, basically things like fashion are the first things to kind of go. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, I'm like looking for jobs, and I would find a job, and then they'd be like, oh, this business is going under, or, you know, we can't hire people in the way that we did. And so I did a lot of, that's when I started transitioning also into freelance, even though, so I was still doing design, and I did it in a lot of different capacities, working for a retailer, or doing freelance work, working for like dance companies, doing more work on like the purchasing end of things. So I did a lot. And then when we were in Miami, I was at my last like big design role was at working for Perry Ellis. And by that time I already had my husband and I started our consulting business that time. And so then I just started like fully transitioning out. And I already kind of had it in my mind, like practically I have to transition out of this career because it's just not working in the way that, you know, I want it to. But then also I do think there was an element of, I started, you know, my love affair with the design when I was a child. Right. Yeah. And now I'm like an adult, and now I'm like ready for the next creative movement big time. Like I've been here in this space for too long, and I'm not doing it in a way that is actually fully feeding my soul. So like, I was also happy to let it go at that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like that Marie Kondo moment. Like, I love you. You've served me. Now I'm letting you go.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, Oh, it's coming up. I told you I was going to bring it up. Ha ha. I have a theory of 18 years. Audience, you know I talk about it every time. And I totally teased it to her, and I didn't tell her what it was. Okay, so I appreciate this idea of you becoming a new person, because I really do think that we go through like stages in our lives where we're like different kinds of people, right? So like the first round is 0 to 18. You're your parents' kid. You do what they want. Yep. They control pretty much what you're doing. Your life is built around, you know, what you see, and it's their life choices that form what's going on with you, right? Then 18 to 36, that's your second round to now be yourself. You are sent out in the world. All right, you're an adult now. Figure it out. And there's trial and error for the next 18 years because, you know, there's so many different kinds of things that you need to learn. Not only like, how do I pay rent? What happens here? How do I, you know, move to another place? Or like, how do I make adult friends? What's a job? And how do I get health insurance? Those basic things. But then there's also like probably multiple roommate situations, various ups and downs where like things work out with friends and not, and you're like dealing with being an adult and like, how do I emotionally deal with this stuff and everything, you know, 18 to 36 is like a huge chunk. But the idea, so then at 36, I think you become another person. Like you've lived through that, but like you're 36 to 54, you, it's a different person because they, you know, you went through a lot and you accomplished another 18 years and you can, okay, I did it. I sort of graduated my first level of adulthood. And then you're still there, right? It's 36. Okay, keep going. No, keep going. And you're like, what do I do now? Right? Because like 18 to 36, there's a lot of like formative stuff that you can do. Go to school, take certain classes, start new things. But once you turn 36 and you're older than that, people start like looking at you weird when you want to learn new things. And I totally think people should learn new things till the day that they die. But culturally, there's like a, you know, we don't really deal with what happens after your mid 30s. You know, it's like, oh, and then the rest of your life. And I'm like, you know what? If you roll through in 18-year cycles, you have like two or three more to go. That's a lot of things. That's a whole journey, right? So this idea that you let go of this fashion thing that you had held on to, not just from childhood, but almost all the way through your sort of second cycle is, number one, amazing that you maintained it, right? And that you kept interest in it, because a lot of people totally change. Like they're like, oh, he used to do sports and now he's a ballerina. And you're like, what? You know, so people like fully make huge changes as opposed to your situation where you're like, oh, I used to do fashion and now I'm going to do like some another art adjacent situation. You know, what are your thoughts since I've presented my theories? What do you think about this?
I would say, like, I think I agree with the general concept, like the overall concept of we go through these phases. Yeah. But I would say for me that they're definitely not that broad. I think they're smaller. I would say maybe more like 7 years. And I think there's more of a, what I would call like a taffy pulling experience where there's not clear delineation. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about like the 18 to 36 figuring it out, like I was the oldest child and I was also the third parent in my household. So I was also like super responsible, like way more responsible than other kids in this weird way. So like the idea of like, not like, there was culture shock when I moved to Chicago, but there was absolutely not like me not knowing how to navigate the world. Like I definitely knew how to get an apartment. I definitely knew how to get a job. I knew how to pay bills. Cause like I was having a hand in that stuff for my own family. Uber responsible, if anything, too responsible, which kind of contradicts what I said about being an artist, but they still did go hand in hand. And I think at least for me, and I think for a lot of people in Black families, there's this also the sense of familial responsibility and obligation. So even as I was doing fashion for myself, it was not entirely also for myself. It was also for the family, because it's also like, I have to succeed on their behalf. Also, I have to succeed so that I can take care of my family who is struggling and who has sacrificed so much for me, right? So like there was a different, and if I let it go, then also like maybe then their sacrifice was not worth it, right? So I think for me, so like even within that time, like I was several different people living several different lives artistically, you know, because especially with something like fashion, like you go through artistic phases within that, right? So there's fashion as a job, which is just like, you know, a lot of computer work, actually. It's very little of the glamorous stuff that you see, which is also part of why I'm like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but then the outward expression of fashion, you know, was my own to be different as often as I wanted, right? And so even within holding on to that fashion, there were still other things beginning. Like I began improv far before I gave up fashion. So like they were, so that's like that tacky pulling effect, mm-hmm. where you know, and even before I began improv, I was reconnecting with my writing, right? So, so that it's like, as one is ending, one is beginning. And so like, there's not this clear delineation, but I would say it's more like a 7-year cycle versus an 18-year cycle. Cause I have been 19 different people from the time that I was like, you know, graduating at 18, leaving my parents' house for the first time and being afraid to tell them I have a boyfriend and he's white, you know, all the way till like 36, which was only a few years ago. I mean, even to 30 or to 25, I was like completely different people at all of those ages.
Yeah.
And in very different areas with a lot of my peers, because I was this kind of more a responsible child who had to be responsible and I carried like a, you know, a burden, which I think a lot of people do. I don't think that's unusual. But I definitely, it was, even though there was this lighthearted, like, yes, I'm, you know, chasing my art and doing these things, there was still like the, I have to make this work. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a different, it's just, I guess it's just a slightly different perspective, but I do agree with you with like the idea that there's these cycles. But I also, I don't know, and this is also maybe different for Black women, because culturally we start behind. The idea of like getting to like 36 and being like, life is over is not a thing for us. For us, it's actually life is beginning, right? Like now I have options. The things that I couldn't do when I was younger, I can do them. I have resources now. I have avenues now. So it's like I hear like some of my other girlfriends who are, you know, who are like, my life is over. I'm like, not mine. I'm actually like living right now. Like, this is amazing. Like, I don't feel that pressure to be like, I have to stop doing new things. I'm like, no, I'm just starting to new things because like you guys got to go to like, you know, the Bahamas when you were in high school. And like, that wasn't something that I could do until many years later. So, you know. Like,
yeah, it's like, wow,
you know, it's like a whole different.
I've never been to the Bahamas now, you know? But
I've not actually been to the Bahamas, but I've been to the Cayman Islands a few times.
Oh, fun! I like it. Yeah. I I appreciate that this idea that like, you know, you feel like ready and more well prepared. I like that. I'm gonna take that. Accept that, and I appreciate that. That's something that people feel, because I feel like a lot of people who I talk to are feeling differently because, well, a lot of the people that I know, I've been doing theater, you know, and film for a long time, and you know, when you get to a certain age, people are like, "Well, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
You don't look good anymore."
Oh, that is real.
And so real, I think that that's a problem like, that I encounter.
It's like, that's totally real. Like ageism is totally a thing, but it's also like, and I can stage my own production and you can't stop me.
So, oh, yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like yeah. I don't know. That's just me. I think I've always had that kind of level of audacity of like, oh, well, I'm going to do my own thing. Like, you know, be a part of a fashion show just because I want to, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been producing my own stuff for my whole life because people were like not casting me in things. And I was like, yeah, all right. Well, I guess I'll do this. I guess I'll make this on my own. So that's definitely how it is. But no, what I mean is I just appreciate this perspective of like, now that you're over 36, like you have, you know, accrued enough lessons and you like have enough knowledge now that like, maybe you're gonna be all right because you've been through some stuff and like now you can handle it. And I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, like sometimes I feel like confident in my abilities to deal with insanity. Certainly the last year or so has been pretty wild. And my like not going off the deep end, I was like, oh, good job. That's good job for you. But you know, I like this idea of being like, yeah, this knowledge that I accrued over this time is going to help me. That's much better way of looking at it.
And I think some of it is just like, I think it's like a practical place. It's just like when I was younger, like, you know, going to college full time and working full time and then going out on the weekends with my girlfriends and doing homework and doing all my chores alone, you know, like that was so much. And I look back on that time and I'm like, I could never do that today. But, you know, when I was young, I had the energy of youth and I could just like grind it out. You know, but so in some ways, getting older to me is like a huge blessing, because I talk about this a lot, like the physical limitations of like a body that, like, if I stay up too late and then the next morning I'm like, I'm wrecked. You know, when I was younger, like, you know, I remember going out late to the bar, coming, waking up the next morning and being like, I'm going to go run 10 miles. Right. And like, and then do all my errands and it's fine. I could not do that now, but it's also a blessing for me to be able to say, oh, I listened to my body and my body says rest and I'm going to rest. And then when I come to my work, I'm doing it from this place of, you know, more relaxation and more groundedness. So I don't know, I love getting older. And I think I just remember this old episode of like Oprah, where it was like her and a bunch of like old divas. And she was just like, I love turning 40. Like you grow into your power. And then like, as I got to that age, I was like, she's absolutely right. Like, my God, like middle age is an amazing time for women. Like, don't be afraid of that. Lean into your power, lean into your power.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward till I get to the Golden Girls level. I'm looking.
Oh my God.
I think that's going to be a good time. You know,
I will have no F's to give.
I'm just hoping, you know, because like my mom kind of has a similar lifestyle to that, in that she lives in condos alongside her other, you know, widowed friends. And so it's like all these old ladies, older, not old, mom. Older ladies who are all hanging out together, and they like go work out and do like water aerobics during the day, and then like, you know,
amazing.
It's great. I mean, and they're totally there for each other. Like, you know, like all the craziness that's going on, I'm like, are you and your friends taking care of each other? You know, and she is, of course, but it's like all this, it sounds like so much fun. You know, I'm like, oh man, 70 sounds great.
Right? Well, it's almost like living back in a dorm again. You know, it's like we're all hanging out together.
Yeah, right? Here we go. And to take a feather out of your cap from earlier, Sherry, let's get a 401k so that I can move into those condos.
After I cashed out that 401k, I did not have, I don't think I ever got one again. Actually, that was kind of the end of it. But it took me where I needed to go.
I don't even know if they exist anymore. It's hard to know in the way that finances work.
Ugh. They do, but get a Roth IRA if you are an artist. Okay. And start funding it now. No matter how young you are, your older self will appreciate it.
Okay, good to know. There is solid. Look at you. You said you weren't good at math, but look at you. You're giving solid accounting advice.
Sherry Flanders, improviser and financial advisor.
Oh my God. Add that to your resume like immediately. Like that's legit. I'm receiving your advice. You've just done it.
Oh my God. I'm pretty sure the SEC is going to come for me. They're going to be like, that is false advertising. You're not licensed.
You're not licensed to tell me to try something? I don't know. No. I don't know. I think you can tell me to try anything. If I do something and then I try to sue you, I think that's a problem, you know?
Yeah.
Oh man. So hey, speaking of business, you mentioned that you and your husband started a consulting business. What did you consult on?
Yes. We consult nonprofit and for-profit businesses on how they should run better. We do a lot of different things. At the beginning, when we first started, I was rolling in my design experience and my writing experience. So we were doing a lot of branding, marketing from my end. He's somebody who has worked for over 20 years in nonprofits as like executive directors and development directors. So we did a lot of fundraising, grant writing, that kind of stuff. And so early on, he was like, hey, you're a good writer. I'm going to show you how to write a grant, right? Because he was already like, you know, when you like get married and then your spouse is like, you're going to do all the things that I do now, right?
Yes. So,
yep. Right. And so, it's just a thing. You're like, I didn't know this was a hobby I was going to have, but here I am. And so he would be working for various nonprofits and I would be there helping volunteering. And I'm like, this is great. I love volunteering for good causes. And then one day he was just like, you're going to learn how to write grants. And I started to do that and I was like, oh yes, I'm good at it. And I started learning the ropes and we talk shop as you do and getting more and more involved in it. And now I also work in nonprofit consulting, and have my own little mini resume compared to it. So it's great.
Hmm. You mentioned also in your something that you had said earlier that you, around this time, also got back into your writing. Is that the grant writing that got you reignited your love for writing?
No, actually, this was prior to the grant writing. So like when we first got together after I graduated, or we got together right before I graduated, and he was working on a film script at the time. And I started helping him with it. And he was like, oh, you're a good writer. And I'm like, I know. And and so he was, but we were both looking at the script and we're like, the script is supposed to be funny, but it is not as funny as we would like it to be. And he was like, oh, we should take classes at the Second City. And I had been in Chicago for a while, but like I knew what the Second City like was, but it, you know, other than knowing like it's a place that comedy happens, and I think I had seen like one show there, like I didn't have really a frame of reference for it. I didn't understand like what it meant in terms of comedy, the comedy world, like improv. Like I had maybe been to I think I did like a comedy sport show like years ago. I went to go see one, you know, so like I, you know, I knew generally what improv was, but it was not really on my radar in any way. And so then we went to take these classes, and he took a writing class, and he's an English major, so he immediately was like, I'm beyond this class, never mind. But I took improv, and I was like, this is amazing. I'm having the time of my life. This is so fun. So I reconnected with, you know, my previous years of performance, and I was like, I had forgotten how much I loved this. And then I dragged him into the improv classes. And so then we were kind of off and running, but it was that getting back into writing a screenplay that was kind of reignited writing for me in a creative sense.
Oh, that's really nice. I like that it was trying to help your husband. That's really sweet. It's like, yeah. It's like you, he made you learn how to write grants, but you helped him write a screenplay. Did you finish a screenplay?
The funny thing is, yes, there's a box full of drafts in the garage, but we never went back to it. Sometimes I'm like, one day when I'm like 80, I'm going to finish and produce this screenplay. But we've written other things since then. But yeah, it was interesting.
It's okay. I mean, some things, we'll write again. You don't have to finish it at all. Sometimes writing projects are there just to get you through something, like for sure.
Sure. But I'm one of those people. It's like, if we start a movie, like, and it sucks, like, I have a hard time turning it off.
Oh, no.
I'm like, I have to watch it. Or if I'm reading a book and I'm like, book sucks, I still feel like I have to finish.
Oh, no.
So it's just one of those weird things. It's like always in the back of my mind, like, I have to finish it.
Now I feel like I have to warn you. Don't watch Bruce Willis movies if you've never heard of them. If you see it and you're like, whoa. I mean, Bruce Willis is in this movie. It must be good. No, no. There is a handful of terrible Bruce Willis movies, and I've watched them all because I was like, but Bruce, he's great at stuff. And then we held on way too long. My husband was like, can we turn this off now? And I was like, I swear, Bruce is going to do something great soon. And he did it. So I just wanted to warn you so that in case you guys are going to watch a movie later, you're not like, you know what? It'd be fun. I've never heard of this random, clearly straight to video Bruce Willis movie.
Oh,
look, it has another random famous person in it. No. No.
We like those movies, though. Oh, that's just who we are. We actually now do a lot of film and theater reviews, and we just got finished covering Sundance. And yeah, most of them were amazing. And, you know, and then there was like one or two where we're like, we're gonna skip this one and pretend like we didn't see it.
Yeah, I saw that you do a lot of reviews about different kinds of things. You did a review on like an improv show and then, you know, a film. How did you get into that? Like, how did you, so at this point in your journey, you know, as you've told me, you know, you've reignited your love for writing through the Second City. Yeah. And that's great. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad for that. That's a wonderful thing. And
now I teach there. What?
Great.
So random.
No, that's wonderful. I love that. And you still teach there right now, huh?
Yeah, I teach in the A3E program and in the music improv program. So mostly the newbies. I love teaching the newbies and being like, yes, hello, improv is fun. You know, the same way that I kind of came into it. It's a good time.
Oh, yeah. I teach level one and I prefer my level ones. Tell me you've never heard of improv. I want to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Because you can just like blow their mind like every 2 seconds. It's so good. They're not jaded yet.
Well, I also just really like creating a foundation for people so that they can enjoy it on long term. You know, a lot of times people are looking to take improv for like the short bursts of like, you know, applause and laughter, and that's what they want and that's what fills their cup. But I think there's so much more to it, and it's not, yes, it's great when they laugh. Yes, it's great when the audience is with you, but like the whole experience of you and your teammates and like what that is, just not only as a team building, like we're all bonded together, we had this experience together kind of thing, but also how do you then take these skills and use them in the real world? So I'm always talking about stuff like that, and like how I try to debunk this idea that you have to, in order to be good at improv, you need to be automatically funny and you need to have these series of skills. And I was like, no, improv is like breathing. Yeah. Everyone can do it. It's really just like, how's it going? Like some people aren't breathing great. And you're like, are you all right? And they're like, I'm okay.
Are you alive?
You know, that's the way they are. You know, some people need assistance to do such a thing, but you have to, you know, figure out how to do the path and then connect with your scene partners. And just like learn them. I'm like, if you're going to work with somebody, know them. What do they like? What do they want? Yeah. What are they, what do they always offer? Like pay attention and then it'll help you, because then you're like, well, Tom loves setting it, you know, the location in a fast food restaurant, like every time. So like, let's just do it for him. We walked on stage and you're like, Mickey D's, man, I love it. And he's like, yeah. And like, that's his jam, whatever it is.
Let him get it.
Yeah, let him get it. Why not? Makes it easier. Yeah. He feels cool. And then he's at ease and he can chat with you. Yeah, I love level one. Gosh, I love level one. It's super
the best.
Yeah, it is really nice. I teach 8-year-olds too, and they sometimes blow my mind with little like truth bombs about like, it's so fun when your imagination goes. And I was like, it is fun.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm so glad you ladies are having a good time. Yeah. My little 8-year-olds, bunch of ladies, love it.
Oh, they're going to be so funny and amazing when they grow up. And I'm going to be like, ah, I love it. I always tell my students, I'm like, one day I'm going to be like, I knew you win. And they laugh. And I'm like, no, it's true. I'm going to be like 80 years old and I'm going to see you one night on TV. But no, I always tell my young students, because I remember like an experience that I had. I used to perform at a theater in Miami called Just the Funny. And it was a really great few years when we were down there, because in Chicago, it's a really competitive scene. Like I got into it just for fun, but a lot of people come here like because they're like, I want to be on SNL or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's a different audience, and it's a lot of times your audience here is like other improvisers who are laughing for different reasons than an actual non-improv audience would, right? So it's like, oh, you messed up. I'm like, okay, that's weird, whatever. But in Miami, it's like a very sincere, like real audience, not because there's only so much improv, and so the audiences are just anyone else. And so after our shows, we had this ritual where the audience is leaving through the lobby, and we would all come from backstage and kind of like be like, thanks for the show, thanks for coming to our show, sort of thing, right? And we got the feeling of like how you did based upon you know, the crowd's reaction. If they were like, you're great, oh my gosh, let me take a selfie with you, or if they're like not making eye contact with you, right? You're like, oh. But I remember one particular night, which really taught me so much, which was we had this audience that was just quiet. Like, and like we were on stage and we felt like we were in the zone. We felt like we were killing it. And the audience was just very much like golf clap. And we were just stunned and we were like, we're bombing, but I feel like we're doing good. And then afterwards, you know, we're like, bye. And they're like, oh my God, you guys were so good. So amazing. It's amazing. And I realized like audiences express their pleasure in different ways, right? it's not always like, woo, loud laughter. Sometimes audiences are quiet because they're intensely watching, because they're just in it so much. Sometimes they're holding their breath because they're like, this is thrilling. And there are different types of laughs. Sometimes they're laughing with you. Sometimes they're laughing at you. Sometimes, you know, so I always tell my students, like, not every laugh is the same. And don't place your worth on the laugh or the audience response, right? Just be in the work. Be in the work. Yes, you can play with the audience and play off that energy, but be in the play with your fellow performers. Like, that's the most important thing. Just enjoy it.
Yeah. Man, what an interesting choice you made when you were in Chicago that Second City was the place that you ended up.
Yeah, it was just there.
There's so many. There's just so many, and like that's the location. Tell me about the way that their style of, you know, like writing and improv into writing affects your current writing style.
I will say that the good thing about having an artistic life before coming to improv is that I understand my creative process and how I get to my place of creativity, how my writing works, things like that. So I wasn't coming to it being like, I'm figuring out creativity for the first time. Yes, there were different mechanics. Yes, there was a learning curve. Obviously, I was not like, I'm a brilliant improviser right off the bat or anything. But I was able to bring my, like, you know, my own creative vision to it. And so when I learned about writing, it wasn't that it like dramatically, or excuse me, writing for sketch, it wasn't that it dramatically changed my style necessarily, but I learned like new concepts and applied it to what I was already doing. So like, especially like editing, I mean, just a basic thing. I'm a verbose person. I know that about myself. But you know, the ability to be able to find more succinct edits, to be more succinct with my words, that was probably the biggest thing that I got from it, you know, to find those punctuation moments. That was probably the biggest influence on my writing. You know, and then also to be able to bring in that levity when I wanted to. Because I think when you come to writing as a writer, you know, it's more serious, heavy grounded. And so understanding the power of levity, even in a highly emotional, charged moment, you know, that is a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. When right now you do a lot of, you know, writing, you review improv and review films and stuff. How did you get that kind of job? Like, so it makes sense, you know, you're writing on your own, you're working on screenplays, you get involved with this theatrical form improv, that's fun. There's a little bit of writing in there, but it's very specific. And then you also learn grant writing, but now you're writing for like magazines and articles and stuff. Like, how do you get into that world? That's a different kind of thing, certainly for writers who might be listening, like, hey, I have written sketches, but how do I possibly write for a magazine?
Yeah, well, it was definitely accidental and organic, like a lot of my career choices. I always was a person who was very confident in my writing skills, like, you know, full stop. I was always like that student in classes where teachers were like, you're such a great writer. Like, even in fashion design school, they were like, do an extra project and sew something or write a 10-page paper. I'm like, I'm writing a 10-page paper, you know, should have been a sign, but, you know, didn't pick up on it then. So I'm going through the improv community. I'm taking classes, Second City, IO, doing shows, all the things. And there were some local kerfluffles in journalism. Basically, this kind of the same thing kept happening repeatedly, which was people in theater, people in comedy would do a show, and a critic, and there are several very prominent white critics in Chicago, would write a review of it, and they would not really get certain cultural references. They'd make kind of really ignorant remarks, and the entire community would get really mad and try to get through to them. They wouldn't hear it. They'd be like, well, you don't have to listen to you, sort of things. Like, it was a bad scene. And one particular reviewer reviewed a theater show called Passover that was at Steppenwolf. And she said something super insensitive, and the community was like, that's it. We're not giving this, all of like a whole lot of theaters were like, we're not giving this particular critic free tickets to see any theater shows anymore. It was a national news, a huge thing. And in response to that, an organization, the Chicago Theater Accountability Commission, Chi-Tac, I'm not quite sure what that acronym is, put out a call for people who wanted to try their hand at writing, right? And so I was like, okay, I can write. I think I can do this. And I tried it, and I wrote a review, and it was good. And someone who had from a paper called Barry Rizzo, one of my friends, who had a site called Chicagoland Musical Theater, had reviewed, one of his critics had reviewed my musical earlier, and he was like, I see that you can write. Would you be interested in writing for me? And I'm like, well, yes, I would. And then I started writing for him, and then several other publications asked me to also write freelance for them because they saw that I was doing this, and everybody at that time was like looking for new voices because there were a lot of stale voices out there. And then kind of one thing led to another, and eventually I applied for a grant with Sundance, and I was part of their press inclusion initiative, and I was invited to cover Sundance, and that was kind of like my entree into covering film. And it's been so much fun because especially so when we talk about like those different phases of life, this was also a phase for me who I had come to the point now in my improv experience where I was like, I've been doing this for a while. I'm feeling like, you know, I wouldn't say expert, but like I'm solid. Like I know the basics. I, you know, been putting up shows. Like I know my way around this world. And to the point where maybe I'm starting to get kind of bored and stale of certain things, doing them over and over again. And then I was invited to have an eye to look at other people's creativities, even outside of the world of improv and more into theater, and then be inspired by these longer format pieces, and then have that feed my own creative writing. So it became kind of this wonderful feedback loop where I'm like, oh yes, here's a new way of seeing the world. Here's a new way of engaging with art. And it's just been wonderful.
Man, that sounds amazing. I love that the cycles that we've talked about are, you know, you're always doing writing just with different ways. You know, you're reinventing the way of writing and finding a new spot where you can be the most helpful. And then also like, where am I needed? Your story, by the way, makes me think again, we were chatting how funny it is, like the world of having the internet and previous, when you were like, yeah. And then one thing led to another, and I was writing for a few magazines, and I was like, I don't think that's a thing that happens now, but like, I'm so glad that it worked out for you in this moment, and that the world was such at the time when people were like, well, let me send an email to this person who's cool and see if they want to write stuff. Like, that sounds great. I don't know exactly how
that's a very special Chicago thing. Like, Chicago is a very... Chicago has always been, and that's been a thing that I think part of what makes me love it so much is that it's a very chill town and people are accessible here in a way that I don't think that they are necessarily in other cities. Like, if you want to talk to somebody, like, you can get through to them pretty easily. You know, it's just, I don't know, it's just that casualness of the Midwest. I think it's just a thing. Whereas, like, I felt like if I went to New York or if I went to L.A., you know, there would be rooms that I would never be able to walk into or people that I would never be able to talk to. But, you know, even like local celebrities here, it's like you can say hey to them and have a chat with them after a show and they're going to be pretty chill. And, you know, and if you're that type of person, then I'm too shy. Usually I'm not going to, but, you know, I know plenty of people who are like, yes. And then I had a drink with this person at the bar and we had a long conversation, you know, like it's just, people are just chill. And there's just this organic sense of like, hey, you know, not saying that everything's perfect, but we have our problems if you've been reading the news. Yeah, I think it's just a lot of things happen easier and organically in some ways.
That's so nice. That sounds like such a small town feel in a big city. And that's really great.
I like that.
So I want to ask you, as a means of wrapping up our conversation, you have been delightful, by the way. Oh, it's been a great time. I wanted to ask you what it is that right now is igniting your creative fire. Like, what's the project or the idea? And, you know, no spoilers for anything maybe you're putting out or whatever. But, you know, what's the thing that's keeping you up at night thinking about, you know, oh, I want to do this, or, oh, I have this project that I'm working on, or, oh, we're building this thing. What's the thing that's, you know, in you right now, so excited?
Well, a lot of things, because I've always been the person who's had like my hand in a lot of different pots. One thing that I'm doing is I've started a nonprofit theater. I'm moving very slow with it, so don't expect to see anything anytime soon. And that's on purpose because we're in the middle of a pandemic. You know, so guys, please, if you're listening to this, please don't run back to the stage because we haven't all had our vaccines yet. Take your time. Also just because this time is so precious. Like, we'll never have this kind of time again where we're all at home in this way and the world is on pause. And so as an artist, you know, like I said, you know, looking back to those years of my life where it was like constant hustle, working full time, going to school full time, you know, the 9 to 5, 5 to 9, to be able to pause is just so rich and so beautiful. And so like, I'm taking this time with anything that I do artistically and just like, let me just look at it and let me simmer in it. And so that's really where I am. Like, I'm in a beautiful, almost like, I think of, my favorite place in the world is, in Paris, and it's this museum called the Orangerie. And it has Monet's water lilies, the big canvases, and they're on this arc around the wall in the circular building. And it's gorgeous. And so you look at it and you have the sensation, you sit there, of being in like a boat on a serene pond sitting amongst the water lilies. And that's where I am creatively right now, you know, and I'm like, hoping that on the other side of this pandemic, we will have made the world a better place and we will continue to make it a better place. And so I'm like looking to see what can bloom.
Wow. It's very good, this idea of reflecting. And, you know, since we have these moments, so many of us who have packed our schedules with 1,000 different projects, and, you know, when you finish one, you quickly grab another one because you're like, well, I can't have any time off. That would be crazy. Mm-hmm. People would think, why? What's she doing? And yeah, I mean, there is something really great about being able to take the time to decide what kind of projects you want to do. Even based on what we've talked about, the different things that, you know, the different artistic things that excite you in the moment. Like, you know, sometimes it's writing and sometimes it's, you know, creating clothing and sometimes it's performing on stage or even teaching, you know, or consulting businesses. There's something artful about that.
We didn't even talk about music, and that's a whole other thing with music improv. I mean, like,
oh, yeah.
It's all connected. Like, great. Whenever people are like, oh, I don't like this kind of art, I'm like, why not? It's all connected. It's all beautiful. Like, just let it, it all flows into one each other. There are not these delineations that I see anyway. Right.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, only if you get to a certain point, almost to bring back the idea of like going professional with some things. Like, yeah, if you become a professional lighting designer, sure, they're going to want you to do the lights. Like, that's going to be a thing they're going to want to consistently you putting out there. Right. But, but if you stay within a certain level, I mean, I'm pretty sure Brad Pitt's not like, hey guys, listen, I'd really like to learn how to be a grip. Like, everyone's like, okay, Brad, he can't, like, that's impossible. You know what I mean? Like, but he's not going to be allowed to.
But did you watch The Last Dance or Michael Jordan, which was, I have feelings on that documentary, but that's a conversation for another time. But
I haven't watched it.
But, you know. But he's somebody who was like, I'm the best basketball player, and now I'm going to stop, and now I'm going to go play baseball. You can do it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
I mean, like, I think people, like, we put limits on ourselves, and we put limits on other people, but there is absolutely nothing that says that we can't do it.
Absolutely. Right? And what a great analog to sports. That is exactly right. Especially the poor kids who have the fortune / misfortune of becoming pro early in their lives. It's like, oh, yeah, sweetheart, you're going to turn 27 and need to find a new job. Like, yeah, that's crazy. But yeah, they are, right? So why not have open your mind to the malleability of like, hey, but what are other things that you're interested in while you are doing this awesome job and you are spending time doing like really focused on this thing that you worked hard on? I mean, enjoy that, enjoy it, but also think like, what are other things that I like to do? I mean, and I feel like that's like it for everybody. And I say this even now too, about people who are like, oh, well, I lost my job. I'm in between stuff. I don't know what to do. They don't have blah, blah, blah. I'm like, write down every skill you think you have. Write down what skills you would need to have the jobs you've already had. And then those are skills you have. And then see if maybe you can't turn that into something different. Because most jobs are similar in the what they're looking for. They want you to work hard. They want you to be able to do it on your own without them having to tell you about it. And you have to do it efficiently within a deadline. Great. I'm pretty sure any job you've ever had those rules, right? And you just have to reform what it is that you're looking to do, or open your mind to the fact that, like, you know, I imagine if when you went to school for fashion design, someone was like, hey, you know what you're going to be good at someday? Grant writing. You'd be like, okay, great, whatever. You know, because you don't think of the fact that you even already had the skills at that point to know how to do it. But it wasn't until somebody inspired it in your brain and said, like, you know what, you can do it. And you were like, I can do it. And then, you know, you can move forward. So I really think that that's a great piece of advice for sure.
Yeah. And I would also say, like, especially, and this is like my love letter to people who are between jobs, because like that period, like I've glossed over so much, but that period of like transitioning out of one career into another was very difficult. But one thing that helped me, and I gift this to others who are going through that experience, was grounding myself in the fact that I was enough without a career, right? Because I was somebody who was always grounded in, like, you know, you have to be responsible, you have to take care of all these things. And I remember speaking to a good friend of mine, and I was like, you know, I'm kind of lost without a job. And she was just like, whatever, you're a housewife. I'm like, I don't have any kids. And she was like, you're a homemaker. It cracked me up to this day. But what it meant, what it triggered in my mind was, I am a fully rounded human being without a career. And I have like so many, you know, we could do a whole nother podcast about my feelings about the economics of improv and all of those things. I have very strong feelings on that. And I think there's some bad things about our industry that makes it very exploitative. And so like, I have also feelings about the idea of like art only for art, because sometimes people should get paid. But you are enough without a career. And without even an artistic practice, and that's okay.
Yeah. You are enough. I like that. That seems like a good spot to end, and some solid advice to the people that are listening. Thank you, Sherry, so much for being on the podcast. You have been a joy.
Oh, thank you, Amy. You are also a joy. And one day, after the pandemic ends, I hope to come to Austin and hang out with you.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to see Chicago as well. I don't think I've been there since, maybe 97? That's a long time ago.
Time for a visit. Come on by.
Yep, absolutely. At this point, as soon as they let me travel, I'm going to be traveling as much as I can.
Come on up. We'll find an improv jam. We'll do it. We'll get on stage.
Awesome. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com, or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.